How are you guys doing today? We are nice to see that some people have made it through the holidays. Holidays are always kind of crazy time for us because all of Casey's family is in town. So there's a lot of driving, St. Charles, back here. Actually, on Wednesday, I was at three different parties plus church. So I thought it was only poetic justice that Mike would make me preach that next Sunday after all of that. But it's good to see that some of us have made it through this time. The holidays are always a time for me where there's a lot of memories, a lot of questions that come up. You know, we got New Year's. That's, you know what, 3 days. You ask questions like, what's purpose? What's the purpose of life? What's my meaning? Where am I going in this next year? Am I going to get that raise? Are my kids finally going to mature? Are my kids finally going to leave the house? Some of you might be asking that. But there's this question of purpose that really does come up quite often. In fact, it's in our music, it's in our movies, it's everywhere in culture. My wife likes The Journey, Journey's Will in the Sky, or for those hardcore fans, I know there's probably a lot of you out there, but there's an obsession in this culture with hardcore music of death. Why does it come up? It just comes up because we're always staring at this question, what is my purpose? Where am I going in life? So it's everywhere. There's also, classic 70s. And what I mean by classic rock, I mean 70s. Okay, I'm not talking about 50s. If that dates you, I'm sorry. Classic rock from the 70s, talks about, hey, just live your life. Have fun, enjoy it, pursue life. Girls, rock and roll, do it up. That answers the question. What's your purpose? Well, my purpose is to fulfill whatever gratifies me, whatever satisfies me. It doesn't bring up the question purpose, but it addresses it. Everything we do in life addresses it. If you live your life where you're running your kids around, it says something about what you think purpose in life. Well, purpose in life is family. I'm taking care of my kids. I'm running them to ball games. Everything we do is somehow answering this question. Even political songs, helping others, saving the earth, all this stuff. Now, my movie that I picked for what best described, this is one of my favorite movies, American Beauty, major awards. It addresses this question so dead on. It's rated R. I apologize. But it's called American Beauty. It starts off with this character who, his name's Lester, and he is just stuck in what we would call the American dream, but he hates it. It's this worthless life where he's just mundane, walking through, going to work, great job, makes a lot of money, but has no interest in life, not finding anything fulfilling in life. He's got a disconnect between every relationship that he has. His wife, his marriage is falling apart. His kid does not, have that connection with him. They used to have a strong relationship, but now, not so much. There's a distance there. And he wakes up one day and just says, what is going on with my life? I need to find a purpose. I need to find more meaning. I need to find something that brings value to my life. Now, he pursues this in very odd ways. He starts smoking pot, starts lifting weights. In fact, one day his wife comes home, and she's singing this song, Don't Rain on My Parade, and then halts the car as she turns into the driveway to see a 1970 Pontiac Firebird, which was an unexpected purchase by Lester. So he starts fulfilling and finding purpose and meaning by buying all this stuff, by pursuing the gratification, whatever would satisfy him. I also found, I had to do some Google searches for this, but there's an author out, Richard Leder. He's kind of like a life coach type of guy. This is what he has to say about the power of purpose creating meaning in your life and work. One of the chief requests for filling the true joy in life is purpose. A consistent in the lives of people who experience a sense of day-to-day aliveness is to discover their purpose. We need at our very core, now listen to this, we need at our very core to be somebody. That lets you know kind of where he's coming from. He thinks that for us to find true purpose and to really fulfill this inner desire, we have to become somebody. We need to be great. We need to have something of value about us. He created this group that sort of helps bring these ideals and teach people his philosophy. And what it means is it's called the Inventure Group. And adventuring means daring to venture inward to discover your purpose and then venture outward to make a difference in the world. Purpose. What does it mean? Is it American Beauty? Is it pursuing anything you can find that'll just make you happy? As long as you're happy, that's the meaning of life. That's the purpose of life. Or is it, as Richard Leader would tell us, is it looking inward to find true value so that you can share it with others? What is purpose? What is the meaning of life? Now, this isn't just a secular or outside of the church, you know, question. People in the church question this as well. Michael W. Smith has a song called Trying to Find My Place in This World. I don't know if any of you guys have heard that, any Michael W. Smith fans, huge Christian artist, many, many awards, but I think you should keep looking, is my personal opinion. That's just, that's from a guy who hasn't added anything to, you know, music history, so don't take my word for it. You can check him out on your own. But he raises this question, I'm roaming through the night trying to find my place in this world. And I've just been doing a lot of thinking about this particular question, where's my place in this world? Where's my purpose? And I don't want to totally just trash Michael W. Smith's song, but, you know, there might be a better way we can approach that question. Instead of asking, where's my purpose or where's my place, we might be better served asking the question, where's God in all of this? The question, where's my purpose, really stems from a culture that is individualistic. It just focuses on self. I'm the center of the universe, so I need to find my purpose. And that's really where this question comes from. It may not always mean that when you ask it, but we might want to start thinking of asking that question in a separate category. You know, let's ask, where is God in all of this? How do I fit into what he is already doing? In that question, who's the subject? Is God the subject or am I the subject? And so that's really what I would like to look at today. When we're talking about purpose, talking about finding meaning, just want to know, who's the subject? Who are we really focused on? Are we focused on finding my purpose? Or are we focused on finding my purpose within the purpose of God? The scripture we're going to look at is Deuteronomy 34. Yes, a whole chapter. It's a short one. And as you're turning there, I apologize, I don't know the number. I just remembered Mike does that.
152.
So we're going to look at Deuteronomy 34. Before we get there, I just want to kind of catch you up to what's going on in this story. You see, there's a group of people called the Israelites, and they started off enslaved by Egypt. This is, you know, the Exodus story. It's a few books back. You have Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, and Deuteronomy. Well, Exodus is the story of how the Israelites, they were enslaved by Pharaoh, and Moses comes, bust them out of Egypt and takes them, you know, on this journey following God and wherever God's going to lead them. Well, just after they get out of Egypt and after they've left Egypt, they're wandering around, God comes to Moses and gives him the law and says, here's how I want you to live. The first law is all about, you know, worshiping God. And he says, you're going to be my people. And he makes certain promises with them. You're going to be my people and worship me, and I'm going to take care of you. And I'm going to fulfill certain promises that I gave you to your forefathers a few hundred years back. If you read Genesis, you see this constant theme coming up where God says, I'm going to promise to make Abraham. I'm going to make you a nation. Abraham says, well, I'm like 100 years old. How am I going to have a kid? They have a kid, and he promises you have Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. And he promises Isaac, look, I'm going to make you a nation. He promises Jacob, look, I'm going to make you a nation. And he continually comes back to this one family and says, I'm going to make you a mighty nation so that you will be a blessing to the whole world. This is the plan that I've laid out. This one family will eventually be a blessing to the whole world. And so this is what Moses is telling the Israelites, you know, through this journey. This is when Genesis was written, and Moses is informing these people, look, God is going to take care of us. He's going to fulfill these promises. And they go 40 years in the wilderness, wandering around. Now, that might get a little old after a while, and, you know, all you've heard is this one guy who, you know, has been leading you. He got you out of Egypt. He parted the waters, and you walked across the sea, and all of a sudden, you're wandering for 40 years with one guy saying, look, there's these promises. We're going to be a nation. We're going to have a land. It'll happen eventually. God's going to be faithful. And then you have Deuteronomy. Well, Deuteronomy is sort of Moses' last stand. This is right before they're in the promised land. They can see the promised land. They're knocking on the door. And Moses sits down with this nation of people that have been wandering around. And he says, look, this is it for me. This is the end of the road. I can't go in. I'm going to die here. But this is the land that God has promised you. And he gives them, all of Deuteronomy is this covenant, this treaty between the Israelites and God. And he says, remember this treaty. This is going to bind you to God. This is what God has promised you, and you're going to fulfill these obligations and be God's people. So we get to Deuteronomy 34. He's just got done telling the Israelites all of this. Remember the covenant. Remember the promises of God. And then we get 34. Then Moses went up from the plains of Moab to Mount Nebo to the top of Pisgah, which is opposite of Jericho. And the Lord showed him all the land, Gilead as far as Dan, and Naphtali, the land of Ephraim, and Manasseh, and all the land of Judah as far as the western sea, the Negeb, and the plain that is the valley of Jericho, the city of the palm of trees. Now what you see here is, and I had to look this up because, I mean, these names, and they mean nothing to us, right? We're like just hearing all these random names, probably not pronounced right, but, you know, you could pay for what you get for, right? So you have all these weird names. Well, what actually is happening is Moses is in the lower eastern region, and he's looking out on top of a ridge, and he sees all the land, and God shows him everything, starting with the east of him, and moves north, and then goes all around, so he gets this panoramic view of this land that God had been promising for a few hundred years now, and he gets to see everything. Now, when you start looking at the map, you say, okay, some of this can't be seen from this area. There's valleys and mountains and plains, and you just can't physically see everything from this point that Moses is at. So God was doing a miracle here to show him everything that he was going to inherit, that his nation, that the Israelites were going to soon inherit. And God showed him all this in a miraculous way. And then we see verse 4, and the Lord said to him, this is the land which I swore to Abraham, to Isaac, and to Jacob. I will give it to your offspring. I have let you see it with your eyes, but you shall not go over there. He reminds him of the covenant. This is what it's all been about. I'm letting you see this. I'm letting you see that your nation of Israelites that you've been leading for all this time are going to be taken care of. They're going to be brought into the promised land. He's been waiting, traveling through a wilderness for 40 years, and now God shows him these blessings. Verse 5, so Moses, the servant of the Lord, died there in the land of Moab, according to the word of the Lord. And he buried him in the valley in the land of Moab, opposite Beth Peor, but no one knows the place of his burial. Moses was 120 years old when he died. His eyes were undimmed and his vigor unabated. And the people of Israel wept for Moses in the plains of Moab 30 days. The days of weeping and mourning for Moses were ended. Okay, so basically what you have going on here is Moses just died, but you see some very interesting things in the scripture. You see that his strength hadn't left him. There's some kind of weird words, some phrases. You know, the vision, he still had vision. His eyes had not grown dim. But then you have that he was full of vigor. Now, I had no idea that you guys are going to learn way more about Moses than you ever wanted to know. This is talking about he was still able to reproduce. Moses, at 120, still had it going on, okay? He was strong, and that's just what it meant in the scripture. That's just, you know, maybe he paid someone to put that in there. I don't know. But That's he's full of strength. His strength had not left him. His eyes were still working. He was still strong. In fact, if you read some of the previous chapters, he just defeated two kings, Shion and Og. He just defeated these two kings, led a whole army into battle. Also, he climbs Pisgah alone, this ridge, this place that he dies at. He climbed that alone. It said no one knows where he died, so he went up there alone at 120. He was full of strength. This is interesting to note because Moses didn't step down from leadership because he couldn't do it anymore. It had nothing to do with, well, I'm just not strong, I don't have the passion, I don't have the fire in me. He had plenty of that, apparently. So, number two, he wasn't disconnected from the people. He had to lead this army. The army was still following him. The people mourned his death for 30 days. This wasn't just some, you know, old crazy guy in the wilderness saying, oh, the time is coming, we'll enter the land, and it'll all be great. And all the, you know, all the young kids, okay, it's just, you know, old Moses talking. He still had the heart. He still had the heart of the people. He was strong. He was healthy. Had the heart of the people. He was able to lead. But this wasn't his plan. This wasn't his journey. And he stepped down. So you can imagine seeing a strong leader. You know he's strong. You know he just led you into battle. You love him. Why would he leave you at this point in time? You're just getting ready to go into the land of Canaan, the promised land, where there are going to be more battles and there's going to be more problems to go through. And your leader that you've known for 40 years is gone. He's saying, I'm stepping down. I mean, this would be a frightening time if you were in Israel. I mean, you would have to be freaking out a little bit here because your leader has just left you. Now, what happens next in verse 9? And Joshua the son of Nun was full of the spirit of wisdom, for Moses had laid his hands on him. So the people of Israel obeyed him and did as the Lord commanded Moses. And there had not arisen a prophet since the Israel like Moses, in Israel like Moses, whom the Lord knew face to face. None like him for all the signs and wonders that the Lord sent him to do in the land of Egypt, to Pharaoh and to all of his servants and to all his land, and for the mighty power and all the great deeds of terror that Moses did in the sight of all of Israel. We see two things here that would give maybe a little bit of comfort to the Israelites. Their famous leader just left them, but it says Joshua became his successor, that Joshua was full of the Spirit of God. He was selected by God. This wasn't just a random guy. They didn't take, you know, a church vote. This was a guy who was selected by God. He was full of the Spirit of wisdom. It was evident that God had chosen a new leader, that God was not forsaking them by allowing Moses to die and not allowing him to continue on into the land, but that he was raising up another, Joshua, full of the Spirit of God. Also, we see a long list propping up Moses. I mean, Moses did all these great things. He led you out of Egypt. He stopped Pharaoh. He's done all these signs. There hasn't been another prophet like him that will arise. He knew God face to face. And it says all this to build up Moses' credibility, because it was also Moses who laid hands on Joshua. So Joshua wasn't just selected by God. He was also selected by Moses, and he's got some strong credentials here. The Israelites have every reason to believe that this is going to be the new leader, that this is going to be the man who is capable of leading them in God's way into the promised land and fulfilling these great blessings. So imagine you're an Israelite, you know, I don't know, way back 3,000 years ago, 4,000 years ago. And imagine that, you know, you've just had your leader leave you, the new one's coming. What does this passage mean? This was written to these people before they entered the land of Canaan. What does this mean to them? Well, first it was a call that Israel should remember God's promises. Remember that he promised them a land, that this land wasn't just an arbitrary land, hey, I'm going to give you a cool house and you'll be satisfied, right? This was a land that you'll have this land become a nation, and the purpose of becoming a nation is so that you can bless the world. So he's saying, remember this. Remember that you will be a blessing. Remember that you'll have this land, become a nation, and you'll be a blessing to the world. This would excite them. This would get them ready. Hey, this is the land that God's promised us. Moses wasn't just crazy for 40 years. He was telling us the truth. Here we are, the land of promise. We're going in. It's excitement. It's gearing up for the charge. You're ready to storm the gates. And so he's trying to bring out some excitement in them. He's also trying to get them to remember God's faithfulness. That look how God used Moses. Moses did these great things in your land. Remember how he took you out of Egypt. He stopped Pharaoh. Remember how God used Moses. God is going to use Joshua the same way. The same exact way God is going to use this new man to continue to use as your leader. He's faithful. God is faithful to his promises. He doesn't just throw out these promises and then let you dangle along the side and try to achieve what he's told you to do, but he's right there with you, going to work this out for you. He is faithful to what he has promised you. Now, so I'm sure some of you are saying, well, that's great. I'm glad we got the history lesson in Deuteronomy 34. I'll never read it again. But hopefully, we can kind of start to see what this has to mean to us, that this passage is important for us because it's a call for God's people to remember God's purposes. We see this story, and a lot of times we really glance over Leviticus and Numbers, but we miss that these are books that are teaching us God's story, that God has started with a group of people, and he's bringing them to this land so that they can become a blessing to the whole world. Now, there's some interesting parallels between Christ and Moses and how Christ is the fulfillment of what Moses started, how Christ is the fulfillment of the promises of Abraham, all these, weird, wacky stuff here. I just watched Carson Daly, or Carson, the old guy. You guys know what I'm talking about. Maybe you don't. Weird, wacky stuff, no one? Anybody? That was a joke for the old people. I'm trying to relate. So basically, he's saying, look, you are God's people. You that have said you're going to follow Christ. This is the story, okay, that God has started from the beginning of time in Genesis, and he's worked it up through Egypt, and now, but right before the promised land, this is the story that God is creating. We need to pay attention to what God has already done. And he's saying, remember my promises. I said that you will bless other people. This is our call as Christians in Christ who has come to be a blessing for the whole world. We take up that responsibility. We take up that call to work alongside Christ and work alongside his purposes. We're called to remember God's promises to bless the world. And that's our function, and that's what we take away from this message. Now, that's going to require us to do two things. That's going to require us to stop asking the question, where is my place in the world? Now, when I say don't ask that question, I don't mean that's a horrible question. Forget that question. Anyone who asks that question, is evil, and you need to just forget anything they ever said. Michael W. Smith is not horribly wrong for asking that question. I just would like to tweak it. I would just like to change it and start asking the question, where is God's place in this world? He shows up to the Israelites, and he says, this is what I'm doing. I'm going to make you a nation to bless people. And he's still doing that today. Now, we're not going to be a nation. We're not going to be a nation of Christians. I hope no one really has the false idea that America is God's nation. The world is God's world, okay? The Chinese are God's nation. The Israelites are God's nation. America is God's nation. This is God's world that he has chosen to bring about people, a group of people, which is us today as Christians, to share his message, to share his light, to bless other people. So we have to start asking that question, where is God's place in this world? Now, to make it a little more practical, there are some areas in life that these questions come up. There's some areas in life that we do not naturally ask, well, what's God doing in this situation? What's God's plan in all of this? The first area of life where we ask this wrong question of where's my place is what I would like to define as this sort of last chance midlife crisis. You don't have to be 40 years old to be in a midlife crisis. But, well, to be in a midlife crisis, I guess you might. But to be in a crisis, you don't have to. But this is just sort of the common, you know, cultural faux pas. That's just what they call it, midlife crisis. But these are the people that sort of wake up like Lester did in American Beauty, where they look around and say, okay, life isn't what I want it to be. I need to find some personal satisfaction. I need to go out and achieve something. I need to find value and put value back into my life because it's not there anymore. I think of a couple hard examples. You know, for, I don't know what it is, but for some reason, there have been a lot of leaders in my life, youth leaders, whose wife had left them. You know, there's two. My last two youth leaders when I was in youth group, their wives had left them while they were serving on ministry. Both of them, they got into an area where they said, this isn't for me. This doesn't please me. This doesn't fulfill my desires. I need to find some value. And so they left their husbands. They pursued a different life. And this is the type of situations that come up often where we get stuck in this sort of midlife crisis where it's like, okay, I've done the kid thing, I've done the family thing, but is that all there is? And we start questioning what else is. There has to be something else out there. And that's what these two ladies did. Solomon did that as well. You know, we just got out of the book of Solomon where we saw a man who, at the end of his life, looked back and said, why did I waste so much time? I thought I could find meaning in women. I thought I could find meaning in, you know, owning real estate. I thought I could find meaning in money, but it just didn't work. And at the end of his life, he says, I had this midlife crisis. I pursued life, but it didn't work. Now, the world answers, there's some magazines, Best Life Now. Staying young and retiring rich. How many is that? I don't know. Maybe not many. Five best new strategies for staying young and retiring rich. Here's a cool one for you guys. Build muscle at age 40. Any fitness. So it's got, you know, it's got your sort of life goal and money, and then it's got some fitness in there. Nine quick, easy brain boosters. The new male sex enhancer. Apparently, that's a big deal when you get older. So we see Best Life Now, and the culture says, this will make you happy. This is where meaning is at. If I can just get some money, if I can just, you know, build some muscle, if I can just live life, find some value, put value back into my life. This magazine will solve my problems. It will teach me. It will get me into this place where I'll be able to have value. For the women, there's Glamour magazine. I don't know if any of you read Glamour magazine. I apologize. I'm not making fun of you. I just think some of these are funny. Why guys love your body exactly as is. I can tell you that. You don't have to buy this magazine. I can tell you why. It's because it's better than ours, okay? That's the real reason. Sexy hair in 10 minutes or less. And, of course, the latest fashion, spring clothes. These magazines are trying, I mean, that's really what they're doing. Their ultimate purpose is to say, this is something that's really cool, really desirable. If you had this, you could have value in your life. You would feel good about your life if you could just buy the magazine, learn the tips, get it down, and everything would be set. The Bible answers in a little different way. Matthew 6, do not lay up for yourselves treasures on earth where moth and rust destroy and where thieves break in and steal, but lay up for yourselves treasure in heaven where neither moth nor rust destroy. For where there are thieves, break in and steal, for where your treasure is, there your heart will be also. Now, I would like to restate this. It's okay, I have Jesus' permission. Where moth and rust destroy, I would like to change that to where inflation and where Congress taxes. I mean, how much can you really save up? There's something that could come up. We are at the brink where we are seeing this happen. Okay? I mean, these words speak to us today. It's not just moth or rust, but it's there's no guarantee. There's no guarantee that your treasure is going to last in this life. And beyond that, there's no guarantee that, well, there is. There's no way you're going to be able to take this stuff in this life when you die. There's no way you're going to be able to hold on to it. You know, the Egyptians used to bury you with all your stuff because they thought you could somehow have some connection, you know, be able to take some of the stuff with you. Now, we kind of laugh at that, but there is a growing trend where people are burying their loved ones with their cell phones. No lie. I saw it on the internet, so it must be true. And they're burying people with their cell phones because the people that are still alive want to feel some connection. You know, it's kind of forcing it, but they want some connection there. But I mean, death, that's it for this life. There's no way of bringing what you have in this world with you. So this midlife crisis, you know, the world says pursue life, build up treasures. But God says, you know what, let's approach this a little in a better way, a smarter way. Life is going to end. We all know that. We all know that life is going to end. We can either make a decision now to invest in the future, invest what God is doing. By invest in the future, I don't mean monetarily. I mean invest your lives in your kids. Invest your lives in teaching the gospel to your kids and teaching the gospel to your neighbors and your friends. Invest your life in something that inflation is not going to take away from you. Invest your life in something that the government is not going to be able to increase your taxes on. The second category, and for all of you who are like, hey, he's picking on the old guys, I'm tired of this. All you young guys, me, get ready for it. The second one is adolescence with a college degree. I couldn't think of a clever way to put it, but basically I'm talking about this group of people who they get out of college and they say, okay, now what? And it's not entirely their fault. It's really not, because our culture pushes this youth mentality. It's good to be young. I mean, and you have a whole culture saying, stay young, live carefree. The average age of getting married today is 27. Very stark contrast to 50 years ago. Not that that's bad if you get married at 27, but just kind of showing you how the culture has changed. And there is a driving force in our culture that says, stay young. Don't get tied down, stay young. Be irresponsible. That's a good thing. Our culture promotes that. It puts that on a pedestal and says, if you can stay irresponsible, you can find happiness. Since I'm talking about, you know, I don't want to hurt anyone's feelings too much, so I'll talk about myself for a little while. When I first got married, this was a rough transition for me because I couldn't figure out why my wife always got upset when she came home and I was upstairs playing video games. And then at night, she said, well, can't we hang out? And I said, no, I got to do homework. She didn't like that very much. And I think I'm starting to understand why that might be a problem. Can't play video games, and then when she comes home, do homework, and yeah. Rough transition for a lot of us. My brother, I hope he's not here. And he's doing much better now, very mature, moved out, and he's, you know, and he's still, you know, he's like 21, so. But he's starting to get a little more mature. But I remember a couple years ago, and I guess maybe it was 20, 19, old enough to know better. So he comes downstairs. We're at my parents' house. He's going to college, and he's running a little late for college. He's got to make it to college, and he yells down, Mom, where are my Pop-Tarts? Okay? And I don't mean this in like, hey, Mom, do you know where the Pop-Tarts are? It's like, Mom, why are my Pop-Tarts not in my hand right now? Okay, he goes, showers, comes downstairs. My mom gives him the Pop-Tarts, and he says, you didn't toast them. Okay. The transition can be a little rough for some people. But why do we have this transitional problem? What's keeping people my age? I'm married and having a kid, but I mean I still struggle with this. I still want to be irresponsible. I want to be youthful. A lot of you might do that as well. Just there's got to maintain some sort of youth. A lot of it comes from fear. We're fearful of what we might lose. We're fearful of getting into a life where we could end up like American Beauty, Lester, you know, just running through mundane life, nothing's fun. But I think a lot of it does come from fear. I remember Exodus chapter 3, where Moses was living out. He left Egypt because he grew up in Egypt, but he killed someone who was beating up an Israelite, and so he got fearful that Pharaoh would get upset that he killed one of his workers. So he ran away from Egypt, goes out, hides out in this land in the desert, marries, starts a family, has a pretty wealthy father-in-law. He's doing some herding, and I mean he's got a sweet setup here in the wilderness with a rich father and a wife and a family. And God calls to him and says, "Look, I want you to go back to Egypt. I want you to do what we're seeing in Deuteronomy 34. I want you to lead your people to the promised land. I want you to take them out of Egypt and lead them to the promised land." And the exchange between Moses and God is not the best from Moses' standpoint. He kind of shies away from some of the responsibility that God is calling him to because he's fearful. He's fearful that he's not a good enough speaker. He's not going to know what to say. The Israelites won't follow me. And he kind of beats around the bush until God says, okay, I'm going to raise up your half-brother, or I'm going to raise up your brother, and I'll use him to co-lead the Israelites. He missed out on an opportunity to lead and to be used by God because this idea of fear, this something he was afraid of, kept him from that. And I think that's what we do a lot of times. This group of people that we're too scared to go out and pursue life. We're too scared to become responsible, start families, start ministries. Not everyone has to get married. That's not the only benchmark for maturity. But demanding for your mom to cook you breakfast in the morning when it's time to go to college, what keeps us back from that? It's this sort of fear, or just we want to keep things the way they are. I don't want to be responsible. I don't want to give up my youth. Now, the world answers in multiple ways. Vacations, I think, are one. I'm kind of a vacation Nazi, so don't listen too much what I say about that. TV is another. Man, we waste so much time on TV. And you don't have to be an adolescent with a college degree to waste time on TV. Maybe that's how you handle your midlife crisis, is just to disconnect. Not to pursue life and to pursue all these pleasures, but to just completely disconnect and just sit down in the TV, you and the TV, have a relationship. There is so much more. One of the great things that I kind of get on, and it's because I don't desperately do not want to be that father that sits in front of the TV. For me, it's going to be video games, and does not have a relationship with his daughter. That cannot be me. That cannot be me. If that's you, what is keeping you from having that relationship? The TV does not satisfy. If it did satisfy, you wouldn't be back at it 2 hours every night. But we keep coming back to these same things because they leave us dry and empty every time. And so the world says, hey, vacations, TV, and video games. This next slide, I was kind of weak. I didn't know, because for those who don't know what video games are, you're not going to know what this is. This is a sort of a catalog of video games. You have the Wii, the PlayStation 2, PlayStation 3. The Xbox is missing. I don't know why. That's the greatest ever. But that is a someone's library of video games. This is what people literally will lose their lives to, okay? Literally lose their lives to. I don't know if any of you have heard of the video game called World of Warcraft. This is my brother's favorite, and I cannot play this because I will lose my life to this video game. It's that addicting. There's a thing called World of War Crack. I said that right. World of War Crack. It's sort of an Alcoholic Anonymous for video gamers that cannot get off this game. I've heard stories of people playing 36 hours straight, 72 hours straight. There's actually been a person who died because he didn't get enough to eat and didn't go to the bathroom enough because he stayed in front of the computer playing World of Warcraft. It is a for real, I don't want to call it an epidemic, but it's for real problem that's out there. And this is my problem. This is what I will tend to run to, is to sit down with this video game because it's something fun to do and it wastes a lot of time. The next slide is just because I thought it was funny. If you can't read it, why waste good technology on science and medicine? Video games. But the Bible answers this in a little different way. It doesn't want us just to be lazy. It doesn't want us to disconnect from the world. But we're going to look at some Ephesians 2:10. For we are his workmanship, created in Christ Jesus for good works, which God prepared beforehand that we should walk in them. Ooh, that W word. The next slide. 2 Timothy 3:16, 17. All scripture is breathed out by God and profitable for teaching, for reproof, for correction, and training in righteousness, that the man of God may be competent, equipped for every good, in the W word, work, for every good work. What is that work? 2 Corinthians 5:18. All of this is from God, who through Christ reconciled us to himself and gave us the ministry of reconciliation. Christ gave us, he died for us, he reconciled us. What that means is he brought some restoration back to from us to God, okay? We had sinned, we left God, we had broken the relationship, and Christ comes back and he restores that. He reconciles us. He brings us back into a relationship with God. And because of that, he also gave us, now that we are in a relationship with God, we now take up this ministry of reconciliation, where we are now reconciling everything. There's verses that talk about how all things are in God. All things are through God. When we are reconciling, it's not just I'm, you know, working on my personal devotional life. And, you know, as long as I learn about Scripture and know, you know, what God says, then I have done my duty as a Christian. A lot of us like to live on these isolated little islands in the middle of nowhere where it's just me and God. And that is not how the Bible talks at all. Ephesians 5 calls us the body of Christ, that we are, as Christians, connected. God died for his bride. He died for us as a group. It's not about the individual. It's about Christ. It's about God, and he died for all of us. He died for his body. He died for all of the Christians. He died for all of us. And he gave us this mission of reconciliation. Now, okay, if Christ died for all of us, and Christ is concerned about the group, what do you think our ministry of reconciliation is going to be about? It's not going to be about the individual. It's not going to be about, if I can just get devotional life down, I'm super Christian, okay? It's about reconciling the world to Christ. It's about finding, you know, obviously the reconciliation between sharing the gospel with other people, but it even goes beyond that. It's about how do I redeem what's in the culture? Music is not inherently evil. How do I redeem music? How do I go into the culture and find areas of arts and places where people are pursuing and look at those and say, okay, that's not entirely bad. There's a good thing in there, but I just need to take that direction and point it towards God. How do we go into the world and do this ministry of reconciliation? That is what the Bible is calling us to do a work, to be active, but not to be active towards pursuing any pleasure, to pursuing anything that our heart desires, but to be active towards pursuing what God desires. For the Christian, this is a call to find God's story. Okay, God is conducting this story of human history where he enters into people's lives and changes what is going on around us. Christ came to this earth to change Okay, there's movement, there's action, there is change that is taking place. He came here to reconcile us to Christ. And we are to partake in that story. It's not just about me. It's not just about what my purpose is. But God has a purpose. He has a story of spreading the gospel, uniting the people, and living in relationship with those people. Connect to that story. Don't let life pass you by because you're too busy staring at the TV or because you're too busy pursuing every little thing you can find in hope that it satisfies. Connect to the story. Find the story. New Year's resolutions, that's coming up a couple days, 3 days. And I just wanted to give you guys something to look at and kind of Google this. But Jonathan Edwards resolutions, the first one, I only have one. I know it says plural resolutions, but there's a lot of them. So the first one, he just starts off. He says, I'm resolved that I will do whatever I think to be most to God's glory. And you might want to think about, you know, check in Jonathan Edwards' resolutions out for New Year's, because this is a time where we start, you know, typically, you know, I don't know if we don't all keep them, but typically we like to make resolutions. And it might be a good idea for us as Christians to think about, how can I redeem that? How can I use that resolution for God? And you might want to check out Jonathan Edwards' resolutions just for some practical ideas of how to be thinking about in daily life, just to think about God first, be resolved to give God the most glory. If you don't know Christ, if you're still kind of on this journey, you're still trying to figure things out, understand that Christianity is more than just a bunch of rules. I have been on a lot of forums online, a lot of, you know, sort of online debates, where there's sort of this growing sort of anti-Christian movement, Richard Dawkins, Hitchens, some of these different authors, where there's like a militant mentality against Christianity. And a lot of them just think, you know, Christianity is this horrible religion where, you know, God plays people like puppets, and Christianity is just about this, you know, random rules, and they go look through the Bible and say, well, look, Deuteronomy talks about not shaving the edges of your beard. That's pretty stupid. And they focus on all these little things without catching the idea that this is a story. Okay, this is a big picture story where God is entering into life. Don't just look at Christianity as rules. Maybe even us as Christians need to think about that sometimes, that it's not just rules of how to live life, but it's an invitation to be a part of something, to be a part of God's story, to be a part of a relationship with the one who created us. And I would ask that you just think about that as we watch this video, and just kind of think about where in my life can I take something that I've been doing, pursuing, where do I need to cut the fat, and where do I need to change the direction towards pursuing God in my life? If you take a look at this video and think about that.